Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The mule's hooves clop on the worn flagstones of the road. The pack animals let out the occasional bray of protest as they wind their way down the path, just a bit too narrow for comfort, their handlers carefully watching their footing and thanking God to be out of the dangerous mountain passes. The Alps rise up in the distance behind them, the peaks covered with snow and wreathed in spring clouds. The travelers don't look back. It's early April of the year 1226. The travelers converse in their Genoese dialect, the experienced merchants telling the newcomers what they can expect as they come down into the Swiss lands and then head for the rich fairs of Champagne beyond that. One of them extols the virtues of a particular bordello in Troyes, another a stew recipe at a hostel in Provins. Their protesting, miserable mules are loaded down with bales of silk cloth and aromatic spices. If the merchants try hard, breathing through noses clogged by allergies and colds caught on their trip through the mountains, they can smell the pepper, cloves, and cinnamon through their careful wrappings. The goods have already traveled thousands of miles to get there, packed into the holds of Genoese ships in Acre and Constantinople for their journey to Genoa, carted by pack animal and wagon across the Middle East and Central Asia before that, all the way back to India, Iran, the Moluccas, and China. Now, they're reaching the end of their journey, their Genoese handlers packing them north along the well-traveled routes to the regular fairs of Champagne. The Genoese already have buyers in mind, a consortium of merchants from Paris who will sell the luxuries on to the wealthy lords of northern France, maybe even to the king himself. It doesn't much matter to the Genoese, as long as the Frenchman's money, or their credit, is good. It usually is. The final lubricant in a commercial system that stretches from the Atlantic to the shores of the South China Sea. The mule's hooves clop onward, down the sides of the alpine foothills, through the evergreen trees, and down into the sharp-edged valleys beyond. The famous Champagne Fairs await, an expression of the deep, ongoing transformation of the European economy in the High Middle Ages. This is a genuine commercial revolution, and it's paving the way for the economy we know and understand today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. When we think of medieval society, a few things immediately come to mind. Knights in shining armor, opulently appointed churchmen saying mass in a glorious Gothic cathedral, a forbidding castle rising up toward the sky. Maybe, if we know the period a bit and we're feeling creative, we might imagine some dirty, downtrodden peasants tilling a field in the shadow of those castle walls, glancing up at their oppressive lords from time to time. Now, there really were knights, churchmen, and peasants in the Middle Ages. Cathedrals and castles and broken-backed serfs were distinguishing features of the period. Medieval people themselves often imagined a tripartite society composed of those who pray, those who fight, and those who work. Clerics, nobles, and peasants, all harmoniously doing their part. All of this reflects, in some way, the realities of the Middle Ages. But there was another side to medieval society, one that had little to do with the hum of Gregorian chants, the clash of swords on armor, or the crunching of a plow through topsoil. This slice of medieval life involved the clinking of coins, the creaking of ropes and sails on ocean-going cargo ships, clattering cartwheels on long-distance journeys from town to town, and the shouts of prices and offers across a crowded marketplace. This was the merchant's world. It might not get much attention in popular accounts of the Middle Ages, but it was a central feature of both the period and its legacy to the world that came afterward. The widespread trade networks and thriving cities that grew into the framework of the modern economy, tools of accounting and credit like bookkeeping and bills of exchange, the institutions and concepts and mindsets that made it possible to do complex, large-scale business all over a continent. These are the roots of our economic world, and medieval merchants handed them down to us. Today, we're going to examine commercial activity more broadly, and then merchants in particular, in our next episode. This was a period of enormous expansion of trade and business in circumstances that were often really difficult. War, plague, a fragmented political landscape, various currencies in use. There were a lot of ways for business to go wrong, as they often did, but the overall trend was towards sophisticated, efficient, and increasingly widespread practices and institutions. That is a remarkable trajectory from the low points of the early Middle Ages, and it points toward the end of our discussion today. A heavily commercialized and integrated Europe, right on the verge of introducing itself to the rest of the world. But before we get to the point of well-funded, speculative commercial enterprises heading west across the Atlantic and east across the Indian Ocean in the 1490s, we need to turn back the clock a little ways. Merchants were not a new phenomenon in the Middle Ages, and medieval people didn't invent commerce. Folks have been exchanging trade goods, sometimes over shockingly long distances, since before the invention of farming. The Bronze Age, the dawn of metalworking and a pretty key turning point in human history, only came into existence in the Near East because some really bright people got the idea of mixing copper with tin, which had to be imported from some distance away. Trade drove the foundation of Greek and Phoenician colonies across the Mediterranean in the first millennium BC, and it made a lot of Carthaginians and Athenians and so on very wealthy. Roman and Italian merchants fanned out into newly subjugated territory as the Roman Republic expanded. The king of Pontus, Mithridates, ordered the assassination of thousands of these merchants in Asia Minor alone in 88 BC. At least in Europe and the Mediterranean, trade hit a high watermark under the Roman Empire, particularly during the first 2 centuries AD. We can see that high point in every kind of evidence. The sheer number of shipwrecks datable to the period, which suggests extremely high levels of overall traffic. Pottery distributions, which show how easy it was to transport relatively low-value goods over long distances. Large numbers of coins, which speak to a monetized economy conducive to trade, and so on. Now, empires can be great for business, primarily because they lower transaction costs. Internal peace and order, less chance of getting robbed, better transportation infrastructure in the form of roads, bridges, and ports, strong legal frameworks that guarantee property rights. These are just a few of the things that make it cheaper and easier for merchants to operate in an empire. No empire demonstrated all of that better than the Roman Empire. The general stability of the Roman Empire made it easier to get information about prices and demand. Regions specialized in different things and then transferred the goods they produced. Olive oil from North Africa, grain from Egypt, pottery from southern Gaul. And they created a class of middlemen, merchants, to do the transferring. The state's insatiable need for goods to supply its armies and the big subsidized cities of the Mediterranean world provided a baseline level of demand that private merchants could then build on. As we talked about recently with our guest Walter Scheidel, there are hard limits to economic growth under an empire, but they're very good at promoting a certain kind of Smithian growth on the basis of increased trade. In Rome, even well into the decline phase after the peak of the Pax Romana in the first couple of centuries AD, merchants still benefited in a great number of ways. Now, as the Roman economy collapsed politically, so did the very specific kind of large-scale, well-integrated economy it had sustained. This didn't happen overnight. It wasn't always or even usually catastrophic. But the simple fact is that across Europe in the year 800, there were fewer people living in materially simpler conditions with far less access to commodities than there had been 400 years before. Far more goods were made and consumed locally. If you were living in a peasant village in central France, for example, you were eating grain you grew yourself. Your pottery was made locally, probably by someone in your village or the next one over. The same went for cloth and leather and pretty much everything else people used on a daily basis. Cities were either much smaller or had disappeared entirely in some places, like Britain. Urban areas thus couldn't serve as the centers of concentrated demand for goods that they had in the Roman period. The logical implication of all this is that there wasn't nearly as much of a place for merchants to operate in early medieval Europe. They did still exist, of course. We can see a few references here and there among the scattered sources of the period. The historian Gregory of Tours, writing in the late 6th century, tells the story of a merchant named Christopher who went to Orléans to buy a shipment of wine, only to be murdered by his two Saxon servants on the way. The elites of the new fragmented kingdoms and duchies and counties of Western Europe still wanted luxury goods from distant places. Merchants met the demand for silks and the like with imports from abroad. But that was a pretty limited market. Europe was a poor backwater in comparison to the rich, thriving Islamic and Byzantine worlds. In basic terms, European elites didn't extract all that much surplus that they could spend on expensive imports. On top of that, Europe didn't have much that anybody else really wanted. It's hard to maintain a viable balance of external trade or a class of active merchants without sought-after goods. There were two exceptions. First, furs from Northern Europe, and second, human beings. The historian Michael McCormick has made a strong argument that Europe's major export in the early medieval period was slaves, and that's what ultimately brought in coins and luxuries for the burgeoning elites of the barbarian kingdoms. We simply don't know a ton about merchants in the early Middle Ages, up to the year 1000 or so. On one hand, this is simply a reflection of how much less commercial activity there was in Europe. On the other, though, it's also a product of the kinds of written sources we have and don't have, and who was writing them. The Dark Ages, to use the pejorative term for this period, weren't really dark because they were bad. They're dark because we have huge gaps in the written record, big chunks of time and space where we have no real idea what was going on. The sources we do have, usually written by monks or other clerics, were more concerned with spiritual life and the doings of kings and nobles than some money-grubbing merchant exchanging precious gemstones or well-traveled Arab silver for a few prisoners captured on some raiding expedition. Mentions of merchants from this period tend to be incidental. Archaeology helps a bit, but it can only tell us so much, and it largely confirms just how local most consumption was. Extremely local production and distribution of goods doesn't leave a ton of room for commercial activity or for specialized merchants. Markets did exist. So did trading centers, like the Emporia of Dorstad and Quentavik along the North Sea. Large-scale monastic institutions in the Carolingian Empire of the 8th and 9th centuries produced enough surplus grain that they could exchange it for wine or other goods. There were local and even regional markets popping up in places like London by the 11th century. But most of those markets were temporary and ephemeral. So was the commercial activity that filled them. That picture begins to fill out after the year 1000. Our sources get better, for one thing, but the more important shift was a real material one. Europe's population started to grow dramatically. More people meant more settlements hacked into the wilderness, more land under cultivation, more and bigger towns and cities to serve as centers of demand, greater regional specialization in the production of goods, and, of course, more trade to tie it all together. Slowly but surely, merchants started to pop up again to carry out that trade. Their reemergence was a fundamental and key part of what historians call the commercial revolution of the High Middle Ages. As I mentioned earlier, practically all societies have merchants of one kind or another. People who acquire goods in one place and offload them in another with the hope of making profit on the transaction. The differences lie in what kind of goods they move, what volume of trade exists, how much profit they can make, and how they fit into society more broadly. Are merchants part of the ruling elite, or are they despised by the great and good? Are commercial activities celebrated or suspect? Are laws and institutions amenable to trade, or do they make it more difficult? The answers to these questions, among others, determine the importance of merchants and how society treats commercial activity. Commerce wasn't completely starting from scratch during the commercial revolution in Europe after the year 1000, but the answers to a lot of what I just laid out came up in that period. So, what was the commercial revolution? Well, the term comes from the historian Robert S. Lopez in a really influential book that came out in the 1970s. Commercial revolution refers to the explosion of economic activity in the High Middle Ages, the enormous growth of the European economy between 1000 and 1300. The population rose drastically, doubling or even tripling. More land came under cultivation. Towns and cities grew. The use of credit and money grew more widespread. And most importantly, trade became ubiquitous, widespread, and ever more central to the broader economy. This last piece is key, and it's what makes this economic revolution commercial. Commerce is the exchange of goods and services, and there was drastically more of it in this period than there was in the early Middle Ages. Increasing amounts of exchange taking place in markets eventually produced classes of merchants who specialized in various aspects of that trade. Lopez dates the turning of the economic tide, the beginning of the revival after the serious reversals of the post-Roman period, to around 950. More recent work might push the roots of that economic growth back to perhaps 800 with the Carolingians, but either way, the basic story doesn't change much. After a long period of decline, driven by high rates of disease and unfavorable climatic conditions between the 6th and the 9th centuries, the population finally began to tick back upward. Demographic growth was the root of everything else. More people, more demand for goods and services, more production of goods and services, more specialization, more surplus, and finally, more exchange. That is the essence of the commercial revolution.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Imagine yourself standing in your average European village around the year 1000. Let's say it's in central France, perhaps 10 miles outside the city of Tours, on a tributary of the Loire River. Even in a highly diverse Western Europe with tons of caveats about the difference from place to place and decade to decade, this would be something like the median experience. We can see a cluster of small, rough houses rather than a neatly planned settlement. The village is 800 years old, and it has been more or less on this site since it grew up around a Roman villa. The villa's long gone, mosaic floors and a lavish bathhouse long since buried under centuries of dirt, but the people have stayed, building and rebuilding their humble homes on this good, fertile soil. There's something like a main street winding its way through the muddle, a sunken, beaten-down pathway for people and animals. A timber tower, an early castle, looks over the village from a nearby hill, an artificial mound called a motte, surrounded by a ditch. The local lord lives here with his retinue of armed thugs, the forerunners of the chivalrous knights of later centuries. The village belongs to this lord. Fields of grain mixed with scattered plots of pasture spread outward from the cluster of houses. In the distance, you can see thick forest and barely inhabited hills. The people who live in those humble houses are hard at work, tilling the soil, weeding, milking cows, caring for sheep, cooking stews, baking bread, brewing ale, and all the other monotonous, difficult activities that define the daily life of the average peasant. When we look at the material objects in their lives, they're pretty much all made locally. There are a couple of potters in the village who make the clay bowls, pots, and jugs the people use on a daily basis. These vessels follow some basic patterns that are common to the region more broadly, but they rarely travel very far from their place of origin. The cloth and the peasants' drab clothing comes from local wool, which the peasants weave themselves. Their grain is grown locally, and practically all of it is consumed locally in the village. The same goes for animal products, including leather. Their knives and other simple implements are likewise made in a local forge. When the peasants trade among themselves, it's always barter. Ale for wool, vegetables for finished cloth, a cow for the use of that field.
They're aware of the existence of coined money, but they don't really use it themselves. The taxes they pay to the Lord come in kind, in the form of grain or animal products, and their labor in the Lord's fields. They know that you can buy and sell goods in the market at Tours, but that's a day's journey away. Besides, what would they need, and how would they pay for it? Now, some things do arrive from elsewhere. The Lord in his timber castle gets carts full of wine from the vineyards of Aquitaine to the south. He wears fancier woolen clothing imported from north of Paris. The chainmail armor he and his thugs wear and the swords they carry likewise come from some distance away, from specialist armorers' forges. The Lord, a keen breeder of horses, acquires stock from all over the region to improve the bloodlines of his mounts. There's profit to be made on those transactions, and a small number of merchants traverse muddy paths and well-worn Roman roads with the luxuries the Lord and men like him demand. But that's a pretty limited market, and it speaks to the generally low levels of trade prior to the full flowering of the commercial revolution. There just wasn't much place for merchants, commerce, or even money in the lives of the vast majority of the people living at this time. Fast forward 300 years to around 1300. The village is still here, and it's thriving. The first thing you notice is how many more people there are. At least twice as many rough houses clustered together in the same basic ramshackle pattern as before, but now a stone-built parish church with an open square out front gives the village more of a natural center. The thick forests off in the distance have been cleared to make way for more arable land for growing grain. The timber castle on its artificial mound has been replaced by a much larger stone tower surrounded by a stone wall. It's a much more imposing fortification, and it speaks to the much greater power of its noble resident. The people who reside here still lead mostly local lives. We shouldn't overstate things. But their world is drastically more commercial than it had been 300 years before. Thanks to a charter from their local lord, the open space in front of the church becomes a thriving market one Saturday every month. Peddlers and merchants bring in goods like cheap wine, ceramics, and good-quality mass-produced cloth from nearby Tours and even more distant regions. The villagers often still use barter among themselves, though coins are much more common, and everybody has access to at least a little bit of cash. Even without hard currency, the villagers are more inclined to think in terms of monetary value for goods and services. It's not just ale for leather anymore. The ale is worth this much, the leather that much, and they make the exchange on that basis. Not coincidentally, this helps with credit. If you can think in monetary terms, then you can keep a running tab of how much someone owes you, which allows for a lot more transactions on a larger scale, even in the absence of money itself. The villagers' material objects speak to a world with a great deal more trade. Their pottery isn't coming from the other side of the continent or anything, but it's not being made by potters right in the village either. Kilns in Tours or nearby villages, which can specialize in the product, are making ceramics on a larger scale and selling it to buyers in the vicinity. The same goes for metalwork. Cloth might still be local, or it might come from a bit further away still, maybe even the cloth towns of the Low Countries, a few hundred miles to the north. Their food, of course, is still entirely from the fields surrounding the village, but thanks to improvements in agricultural techniques, they produce more surplus than they did 300 years before. Much of that surplus goes to the Lord, but other chunks of it go to feed the citizens of Tours, Angers, and the other rapidly growing towns and cities of the region. As for the Lord, he owns clothing made from fine silk imported all the way from China, brought to his castle by Genoese traders. He seasons his food with spices from India, bought from those same traders. He pays for those luxuries with the surplus generated by his peasants. The transformation of this village is the essence of the commercial revolution. More people, more surplus, more money, more trade, and the rapid, thorough growth of a more commercialized society with a more important role for merchants. Somebody had to take all those goods from place to place. If there was profit to make on those transactions, then middlemen, Genoese in this case, would pop up to handle the job. There's a way of telling the story of the commercial revolution that starts with intrepid Italian merchants heading off into the unknown, forging long-distance trade ties between the peninsula and the rest of Europe. Italy was the birthplace of commerce in this old-fashioned telling, and then exported it to Champagne and the Low Countries and everywhere else, along with luxury goods from the East. Those Italian merchants and their long-distance trade are indeed a key part of this story, and we'll get to them shortly, but there's a good reason why I started with the humble village. Because the rise in population, the productivity gains, the surplus those hard-working peasants generated, and the lords who took that surplus, were the real key factors that lay behind the rest of it. That is why we started with that cluster of humble houses, the fields, the rough pottery, the new stone-built castle looming over everything. Because without the peasant's surplus, there was nothing to trade and thus no merchants. Let's come back to the merchants, those wide-ranging Italians. In the early Middle Ages, most of the long-distance trans-Mediterranean commerce had belonged to the Easterners, Syrians, Greeks, and Jews. That started to change in the 9th, 10th, and into the 11th centuries, as residents of Italian cities started venturing outward from the peninsula and brought back goods to trade. We've spent a bunch of time talking about Venice recently, and that was the quintessential example of this shift. A place right on the dividing line between East and West, a strong maritime tradition, and political institutions that could support active trade. Other places that got in on the action included Amalfi, Genoa, and Pisa, and they were just the start. But what made the Italians so well-suited to long-distance trade? It wasn't just Italy's strategic location as the hinge between East and West. It was also the fact that the agricultural advances and demographic growth that defined the commercial revolution began there first. More land came under cultivation, surpluses grew, and so did towns and cities. The people who lived in Italy had never entirely forgotten commerce or urban life, so they had a foundation to build from. But the real key was the close relationship between city and countryside, between agricultural surplus and commercial activity. The landholding nobles and urban elites who were intertwined with them took their rising agricultural profits and reinvested them in trade. We're going to put this in concrete terms. Let's say you're a nobleman with an estate outside Genoa around the year 1100. You invest in some drainage and bring new land under cultivation, which produces a nice grain surplus. Genoa's population is growing, which means more demand for grain, and you sell your estate surplus there for cash. But what to do with those profits? Well, you could acquire more land, but that sounds like a fair bit of work. Besides, you won't see the returns immediately, and there just isn't much land for sale in this region anyway. You could spend it on nice things, of course, but you already have a country estate and a city house and nice clothes. Your neighbors and your social inferiors already know that you're an important guy. So what to do with the profits? Well, Genoa is a seafaring city. There are some sailors who are willing to take trips to the great ports of the East in search of the finest, rarest, most sought-after luxuries. If, that is, they can get some investment capital from a wealthy patron like you. So you pay for a ship and a crew, and you fork over hard currency for them to buy the goods once they get there. The voyage turns out to be a success. They come back from the East with a hold full of silks and spices, which they sell on for a massive profit. Now, you're not just a landowner. You're a merchant capitalist with still more money to invest in the next round of voyages. Trade was expensive to finance. Ships were pricey, so were the costs of crewing them on long voyages, and if the ship sank, which happened all the time, then nobody got paid. Those were all obstacles that had to be overcome, and reinvesting agricultural surplus as liquid capital in trade was the major way of getting over the hump. From there, the whole thing snowballed. With profits rolling in, more liquid capital, a whole infrastructure, ecosystem, and institutional framework built around trade could start to flourish. That's where we get banks, credit, maritime insurance, commercial partnerships, accounting, and all the rest. That is one major side of the commercial revolution. There was a dynamic relationship between the broader European context and the Italian merchant cities. As villages like the one we visited in France grew, slowly at first after 1000 and then quicker between 1100 and 1200, their surplus wealth went mostly to the lords, who attracted the attention of the Italian merchants. They traveled north with their luxury goods, creating a commercial spine that ran over the Alps, up the rivers and roads of France, and toward Champagne, especially after about 1150. The Counts of Champagne, a vast and wealthy region of eastern France, extended their protection to merchants and granted permission for a series of trading fairs in the towns of their territory. They were spread throughout the year in various places like Provins and Troyes, each of them lasting for 6 weeks or so, and they provided a meeting point for merchants from all over the continent. The Italians brought their luxuries, like silks and spices, while fine skins and furs came from the north and east. Increasingly, woolen and linen cloth came from the towns of the Low Countries. Because these fairs happened on a set schedule, the same merchants could come and do business over and over and over again, exchanging information, developing credit in the form of regular cycles of borrowing and repayment, and developing accounting tools to keep track of it all. All of these tools and concepts diffused from the Italians in the south to their compatriots in the north, spreading a common commercial culture and a set of assumptions about how business was done. The Champagne fairs are famous because of their regularity, their stability, the involvement of the Counts of Champagne, and their sheer scale. If you go to the town of Provins today, which is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, you can see the big underground warehouse vaults underneath the houses from this era where they stored all the goods. It's a lot of space for what must have been a ton of volume. But fairs and sponsored markets popped up all over the place during the 12th and the 13th centuries, not just in Champagne. Lords all across Europe realized that they could profit from commercial activity, either by collecting tolls or just by selling a charter for a market or a fair at a fixed price. The volume of activity at regular markets and fairs went up and up between 1100 and 1300, a strong indicator of commercial vitality throughout the whole period. What's fascinating, though, is that even as regularly scheduled fairs and markets grew both more numerous and busier, and more total business was transacted at them, the proportion of commercial activity they represented actually went down. In other words, more and more trade was happening on a regular basis in continuously operating markets in towns and cities. The shopkeepers of Genoa and Venice and Paris and London and a bunch of smaller places did business all the time, not just for the 6 weeks after All Saints Day or what have you. By 1300, the high point of the commercial revolution was winding down. The Champagne fairs were losing their importance as the nodal point of long-distance European commerce, but not because the overall trend of commerce was pointing downward. Very much the opposite. Merchants from all over the continent were spreading their wings, setting up shop on a permanent basis in places like Bruges, Lübeck, Venice, and many others. The temporary ad hoc markets that fairs provided still mattered, especially in the countryside, but they were giving way to permanent commercial centers and cities. That is one way that we can tell that times were changing.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
The commercial revolution remade the European economy, transforming the way that not just merchants, but pretty much everybody in Western Europe did business. But by 1350, the commercial revolution was over and a new phase had begun. Why? Well, a few things happened, more or less simultaneously, that fed into and reinforced one another. First, the climate got worse. Cooler, wetter, and less predictable. This marked the end of what's called the medieval climate anomaly, a long period of really favorable conditions. It's not as simple as saying that good weather produced the commercial revolution, but the whole thing was fundamentally built on a growing population and rising agricultural surpluses in places like that village we visited. When the climate became less favorable to growing crops, which cooler, wetter, less predictable weather tends to do, that baseline condition disappeared. Second, even more than the climate, that explosive population growth had more or less hit its limits. More people meant more land was necessary for growing the food to feed them, and the people of Western Europe had cleared forests, drained swamps, and extended their fields onto rocky hillsides. there wasn't much left to support a growing population, and a lot of the land under cultivation was marginal and not especially productive. Third, events beyond Europe directly impinged on its economy. The fall of Acre to the Mamluks in 1291 marked the end of the Crusader presence in the Holy Land, and that meant the luxury trade with the distant East would either need to go through Muslim states or through the Black Sea. With the Mongol empires split into competing khanates and the accompanying warfare between them, that long-distance luxury trade got even harder and more expensive. These were the underlying economic and demographic trends. Already not great, and a series of events in the first half of the 14th century made them much worse. First came the Great Famine of the 1310s, which killed hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people over a few years of terrible weather, crop failures, and livestock diseases. Next came the outbreak of the Hundred Years' War and its many associated conflicts, which severely disrupted overland trade routes across the continent. Finally, the Black Death erupted between 1347 and 1353, killing somewhere between a third and half of the European population. In addition to causing mass death, the plague was a severe shock to both labor and demand, and it had enormous knock-on effects that remade large segments of the economy. The economy did contract in absolute terms in the century after the first outbreak of plague. Fewer people meant less overall productivity, for one thing, and consistent warfare in both Italy and Northern Europe disrupted commerce. The Ottoman expansion in the Eastern Mediterranean, then Timur's conquests in Central Asia, complicated long-distance trade. There was a shortage of bullion, the hard gold and silver that went into coinage and fueled exchange on a large scale. It wouldn't have been surprising if the Black Death had simply rolled back much of the expansion of trade and whatnot that the Commercial Revolution had produced. It's easy to foresee a less populated Europe reverting to more local patterns of consumption and making use of the suddenly plentiful land left available by mass death. But that's not what happened. Instead, the economy stayed monetized, meaning people continued to both use money and to think in terms of the monetary value of goods and services. With less pressure on resources and land, standards of living rose. Your average person had more access to money. Even if aggregate demand for goods went down, remember, way fewer people, per capita demand for goods rose. This was the formula for what the historian Stuart Jenks calls the distribution revolution. I've mentioned this before here on Tides, though it's been a while, and I think it's a really useful idea. To be clear, where commercial revolution is a widely agreed on concept among historians, distribution revolution isn't nearly as popular. That's a shame because it does a great job of encapsulating a series of shifts that defined the 15th century economy. These were really important changes because they bridged the gap between the end of the commercial revolution, remember growth had stalled out, and the economic explosion of the early 16th century. Merchants played a key role in that process. The reason Jenks calls this a distribution revolution is because the distribution of consumer goods became routinized and much denser over the course of the 15th century. Basically, the commercial revolution had been about two things. First, more surplus, which created the second thing, more demand at the top of society for luxury goods, which drove the formation of trade routes and incentivized merchants and so on. Your average person, like those in the village we saw earlier, was still mostly consuming goods on a local level, even if they were more familiar with markets and money. The distribution revolution built on this first series of developments by establishing regular channels of trade for goods that even non-elites could buy on a large scale. We're talking about stuff like cloth, grain, inexpensive metalwork, leather, and the like, not silks and spices. In technical terms, what this means is a hierarchy of markets and an emerging form of merchant network that connected big ports to each other, and then down from there to smaller regional cities, market towns, and even the lowly peasant villages. It's not that this had been completely non-existent prior to 1350 or so, just that it got much more intense in the 15th century, enough that we can call it a revolution in its own right. The implications here were substantial. Better distribution allowed for more regional and local specialization. Grain here, wool there, cloth production there, and spurred urbanization. People who live in cities aren't producing their own food, but if you can get food from somewhere else, they can do all sorts of things that are really, really useful for the economy as a whole. This includes producing and distributing still more goods along those pathways I mentioned. The upshot was that by 1500, a network of defined, well-understood trade routes with greater volume and regularity than 150 years before linked Europe together. Cities like Lisbon, Seville, Marseille, Genoa, Venice, Nuremberg, Cologne, Lübeck, Antwerp, and London, to name some of the major nodes, all connected to one another, and then they had their own regional and local networks. Goods flowed into London from Lübeck, then down the roads and up the Thames and other rivers to the market towns, and then from there out into the countryside. And smaller ports, too, could connect to other discrete points in the network, forming their own small part of the distribution chain. So let's look at one concrete example of this. The historian Marianne Kowaleski wrote a really interesting book on the regional town of Exeter in the 14th and the 15th centuries, looking at how it connected to the local area around it, the region of Devon in which it was situated, and then the broader European economy beyond that. Exeter was relatively small. It had around 3,000 inhabitants in the late 14th century. In a lot of ways, it was typical of places like it, not just in England, but more broadly. Kowaleski's findings illuminate just how this distribution-oriented network functioned. For locals, people living within about 6 miles, roughly a day's back-and-forth journey, Exeter was their commercial hub. It's where they sold their produce and bought the goods they needed. These were just normal folks, peasants and yeomen, anybody with some surplus or market-oriented products for sale. On the next level up of the commercial hierarchy, more focused, wealthier merchants connected Exeter with the smaller market towns of the region. These were places in the 15 to 25 mile range that might have specialized in a particular good. Leather in Tiverton, for example, or butchery from the upcountry pasture land in East Devon. Above that in the commercial hierarchy were the regional and transregional levels. Exeter was a port, but 70% of its shipping in the late 14th and early 15th centuries was coastal in nature rather than overseas. In other words, ships would pick up cargoes in London or Plymouth or Bristol and then bring it down the coast and up the river to Exeter, from where the city's merchants would sell it on themselves or to additional middlemen who would take it out into the countryside. All of this in Exeter was predicated on a thoroughly commercialized society, and the city wasn't unique. If anything, it was close to the norm for Western Europe as a whole. This was not a bunch of subsistence farmers living among scattered towns and cities, or even one where the elite just sucked up all the available surplus and spent it on imported luxuries. From humble peasants all the way up to the agents of the landholding nobility and big monasteries, people understood money, and they produced not just for themselves, but for sale in markets. Merchants were at the core of this. I've talked about the Gloucestershire wool trader John Heritage on this show several times. I love him dearly. And I've talked to the man who wrote the book on him, historian Christopher Dyer. So Heritage lived right around 1500, and we have his account book covering the years between 1501 and 1520. Heritage's accounts speak directly to this dynamic of increasing distribution. He bought wool in his immediate neighborhood around a town called Morton and Marsh and then transported it by cart every year to London, where he sold it on to the big-time wool merchants who then took it to the continent for export. Heritage then filled his hired carts with relatively humble imported goods like barrels of tar, which came from the Baltic, and took it back to Gloucestershire for sale. He was the quintessential middleman, the link in the distribution chain that brought together the major distribution centers with the countryside. A society full of people like Heritage, right on the cusp of extending outward from Europe toward the wider globe, was the product of the commercial revolution and its aftermath. Next time here on Tides, we're going to meet a bunch of different merchants and dig more deeply into their world, into how they spent their time and how they looked at things. The later Middle Ages were deeply and fundamentally commercial, and that was the legacy they left to the period that followed. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez.
Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.